case number 12-1234, National Treasury Employees Union Petitioner versus Federal Labor Relations Authority. Ms. Wilson for the petitioner, Mr. Hennigy for the respondent.
All right, Ms. Wilson, before you start, and we've got everything out of order this morning, but you all, I know both parties have been asked at least twice to address the finality. And to just to put it to rest, can you tell us what the status of the remand is? Is there anything left?
Well, in this case, whether there's anything left on the remand is somewhat irrelevant, because the only issue that was left was the question of attorney fees. And in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Halleck, if the only remaining issue is attorney fees, that has no bearing on the finality of the decision.
All right. You know what? I've just mixed up this with the
other one. With the other one,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
So this is case 1234,
right.
The workload appeal.
Right.
Okay. So there's, just to be clear for the record, it's our position that there's no question that this is a final decision appropriate for our review by the court. Okay. May it please the court, good morning. My name is Julie Wilson. I'm here representing the National Treasury Employees Union, the petitioner in this case. With me at council table is Gregory O'Dunan, general counsel. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. As we showed in our briefs and will demonstrate today, the FLRA committed legal error by focusing on a single non-dispositive fact to find that there was no change in employees' workload. The FLRA took an improperly myopic view of whether there was a change in employees' workload. It focused solely on the number of cases on employees' case inventories. But the arbitrator concluded, consistent with FLRA precedent, that workload is determined by more than just the number of cases that employees are asked to work on. Instead, changes in workload are affected by a number of factors, and they are a change in case inventory can be a change in workload if it actually changes what the employees are expected to do, how they are supposed to perform their job. Now, the arbitrator reached a number of findings with regard to this question. She found multiple ways that the IRS had made changes in what employees were asked to do. She said that she found that the IRS had control over how cases were processed. She found that the IRS had control over case deadlines, that the IRS had control over the number of employees that were assigned to cases. And when all of that was looked at in the totality of the circumstances of this case, she found that the IRS changed by requiring employees to work faster and to produce more because of the influx of cases, under the case deadlines by which employees were required to perform, that necessarily changed how employees were evaluated.
But it was really just the increase in caseload that triggered all this, right?
No, actually, Your Honor, it wasn't just the number of cases standing alone. The arbitrator, well, she acknowledged that there was an increase in the number of cases. She went on in great detail to talk about the subsequent changes that the IRS took in response to the increase in cases. As I've described, they changed the way that employees were evaluated. They held them to the same standards. They, in some instances, employees were asked to work extra hours to be able to process this. At bottom, what the IRS did was change how employees did their job. Employees were required to work faster and to produce more in the same amount of time.
Now, the FLRA said that its own precedent, though, distinguished between a circumstance where the agency itself makes a change and then there's some external event, and it cited its precedent going back, I guess, to 1980. So how do you deal with what the FLRA cites in terms of its precedent?
We believe that the arbitrator correctly applied that standard, that whether there was a change in practice, policy, or procedure, and then went on and analyzed correctly and to determine that there was the requisite change in practice. The practice at the heart is whether as how employees were performing and how employees were doing their jobs. And there's no question that under FLRA precedent, how employees do their job, their workload, is a conditions of employment that is subject to bargaining. Where the FLRA erred is that they focused improperly on an arbitrator's single sentence that the IRS did not have any control on the number of cases coming in. That's undisputed. What the FLRA then failed to do was read the rest of the page where the arbitrator talked about all of the changes that flowed from the fact that there was this increased number of cases. And when you look at that, at the arbitrator's decision in its entirety, completely, it's quite clear that the arbitrator found that there were a number of requisite changes to support an unfair labor determination.
So the precedent seems to be that it almost doesn't matter what happens after the initial event. The question is whether the initial event was triggered by the agency such that it changed its policy, practice, or procedure. Isn't that the line of authority on which the authorities rely?
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because if you look at VA Sheridan, if you look at the cases that the FLRA referred to, those are very different than the circumstances that we have here. We believe that is an improperly myopic view of the standard, the policy, practice, or procedure standard.
I understand you think it's too narrow, mm-hmm. but that is the agency's precedent, the authority's precedent, isn't it?
Not if you look at the Social Security Administration case, where and you look very closely at Department of Homeland Security case and VA Sheridan. In both VA Sheridan and the Department of Homeland Security case, there were changes. In VA Sheridan, the authority found that there were changes that were brought on by external factors. There was an increase in the number of cases. But what makes that case different than ours is that in VA Sheridan, the administrative judge and the FLRA both expressly acknowledged that there was no change in how employees were expected to do their job. That was very clearly stated in the decision, that there was no increase in hours, that employees were not expected to work faster, that they were not expected to produce things any more quickly or held to rigid time requirements. That is absolutely the opposite of what we find here. And if you read VA Sheridan closely, I think it actually supports the union's position that where you find all of these, the ramifications of what's happened here, if you look at what the consequences of that increase in caseload are, you'll see that the arbitrator found that all of that together meant that there was a change in how employees were expected to do their jobs.
Well, are you complaining about the changes that the IRS did impose? For instance, assigning more tasks to the intake advocates, suspending the requirement to meet the first contact timeliness, and adding 7.5% increase in the case advocate staff. I mean, they tried to address this. And are you saying those changes are what you wanted to bargain about? I mean, are you complaining about them, or did you just want to have your voice heard?
Well, those are all separate changes that would have required standing alone notice to the union and an opportunity to bargain. And we also believe that they acknowledge that the IRS knew it was making an overall change in how employees were being expected to perform. What we're arguing is that when you look at the very beginning of when this change started to manifest, the arbitrator concluded that that was around 2007, the first time that employees were being evaluated against these timeliness standards, the case processing standards, but still being required to produce more and to work faster. That's when we believe that the agency was required to provide notice and an opportunity to bargain to the union.
Because the performance was tied to the caseload and the timeliness, and that wasn't changed? I mean, what is the change that you're talking about? The change that the FLRA sees and that, frankly, I see is the increased caseload, which did not start with or initiated with or proposed by the IRS.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not the change that the arbitrator found.
I know that, but that's the change the FLRA found. I mean, that's what we're looking at.
But in order for the FLRA to find the change, and there's no dispute about the facts here. There's no dispute that the IRS had no control over the number of cases that were coming in. But that's not the end of the analysis. Under FLRA case law, you have to look at the employees' workload is. You have to look at the change and how that affected how employees did their job. So this wasn't simply a question of employees were asked to do two times, three times, four times the number of cases, and hey, they could get them done whenever they wanted to, provided they just got them off their docket. This was a circumstance where employees were asked to do 2-3 times the number of cases under the same very strict time frames, under the same quality controls, under the same performance evaluation criteria.
Well, that's the real thing. If they had delinked the caseload, because they did do those ameliorative changes that I just mentioned, if they delinked the caseload from the performance evaluations, what would you be fighting about?
It's hard to say because that's not what happened here. But the arbitrator concluded that that was the clearest example of the change to employees, the change in practice. So I agree with you, Your Honor, that if the performance evaluation system wasn't in play here, it would be a different case. But that's not what we have here. What we have is that the IRS continued to evaluate employees under a performance appraisal system where employees' work had changed, their workload had changed. It wasn't simply a matter of them accepting new cases.
And what you wanted changed was the performance evaluation. And so that's not a change proposed by the management. That's a failure to propose a change.
No, what we are arguing is that the IRS, when it made the decision to hold employees to the same standards, but knowingly change the way they perform their jobs, they were required to provide the union notice and an opportunity to bargain about that. When the IRS looked at the circumstances and said, we know that employees are going to be required to work faster and harder, that was the change in practice that triggered the agency's statutory obligation to bargain with the union. In short, the IRS, by requiring these employees to work faster and to produce more in the same amount of time under the same requirements, changed, as I've said now, the way that employees are expected to do their job. And the arbitrator put this quite succinctly. She said, by holding employees to the same standards while increasing the number of cases that come in, changes the standards that employees are required to work under. And because the IRS failed to provide notice and an opportunity to the bargain over that change, the agency committed an unfair labor practice.
Could I just ask you, the authority's brief says, well, the union never requested bargaining or demanded bargaining. Was that an option?
It was, Your Honor, but the fact that the union was able to request bargaining does not excuse the agency from its statutory obligation to provide notice. So it is possible that we could have, but that doesn't mean that somehow the IRS could avoid its statutory obligations. And it's clear in this case that they did not meet their statutory obligations.
Or the contract, right?
Or the contract, yes.
And that's not an issue?
No, it is not.
And so what turns on this case?
This case obviously rides on whether there's a statutory violation, and there are remedies that flow from statutory violations.
It's an additional remedy, right?
Because correct.
That flows. But you have the contractual violation either way, correct?
We do. There were no exceptions taken to the contractual violation.
I do have one question about the... There was a make-whole remedy that the arbitrator imposed, and then I lost track of it. Where is that?
Are you referring to the status quo ante or the make-whole on the performance evaluation?
Right.
So the arbitrator, in recognizing that there was a change in employees' workload, she expressly acknowledged that that was manifested in a particular way, and that is how employees were evaluated on their performance. Right. So she ordered the parties to negotiate a process by which employees could come forward and seek a remedy for any affected performance evaluations.
And is that in place?
I'm sorry?
Is that in place?
That has not reached conclusion. The parties have not negotiated a resolution to that yet.
Okay. All right. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Zachary Hennigy. I'm here on behalf of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. This case involves union's attempt to upset the authority's reasonable construction of the statute and the 30 years of precedent, of authority precedent. To be certain, as a general rule, an agency has an obligation to bargain over terms and conditions of employment that it implements and unilaterally plans on changing. But to trigger the notice and bargaining obligation, there's a threshold determination that needs to be made, and that is, did the agency make a change to a procedure, a practice, or a policy? And the conclusive findings of fact in this case show that the agency did not do that. The arbitrator finding that the agency did not significantly increase staff, the virtually the same number of existing advocates were there, processing deadlines were largely the same, no significant change there, no adjustment to job performance criteria. The authority adopting the arbitrator's findings of fact on those issues show that the agency did not make a change. Therefore, that threshold determination was not met.
So is there no set of external conditions that it could ever combine to cause a change under this line of precedent?
Not that I'm aware of. Where the agency wants to make a change, again, looking at the cases that we cite, the Department of Labor Boston is the FLRA 2002 case. In that case, it was an employee-driven change. The employee moved from one department to the other, or the employee had a government-provided car in its prior department. It no longer had that benefit. But the agency just applied the same rules, procedures, practices, policies in the other department. So the agency didn't make a change. The VA Sheridan case that was brought up earlier, there it was customer-driven or patient-driven. Outside of the agency's control, these are things that increased. And in that case, I'm not sure exactly how it was framed, but in that case, it was a volume issue. In that case, there were more patients coming into the VA, and the authority showed described that volume increase, where everything else remained the same, and the authority in that case found that over 5 years, the same types of patients were being treated, the same type of work was being done, it was just more of it. And when that outside of the agency increase, change, if it's employee-driven, if it's customer-driven, when those changes outside of the employee's or the agency's control happen, that's not going to meet the threshold determination. That's not going to trigger the notice and bargaining obligation, at least on the part of the agency. Judge Rogers, as you described, the union certainly has the option to request bargaining, and that's what happened in the Library of Congress case that the union cites in its brief, where a relocation was taking place, and the union wanted to bargain over certain conditions.
How does that process play out in a way different from what they want here?
The union is the one making the request to bargain.
Mm-hmm.
So they see a change, or they realize, okay, something's going on. But if in that case, it was a term and condition of employment, it was a negotiability issue. So it's different than this case in those regards. But that's part of the test. Is this a term or condition of employment? And we're not disputing that workload is a condition of employment. The cases that the union cites, Social Security Administration Gilroy, the Materials Command case, the Bureau of Prisons case, these FLRA cases, they all involve workload changes. But each one of those workload changes involved agency-driven, agency-implemented changes. In Gilroy, it was scheduling appointments. The agency decided it wanted to schedule appointments on Fridays. In Material Command, it was a reorganization plan, but that was agency-driven. That's different than what's happening in this case, where you have, again...
But from the perspective of the employee, it's the same, isn't it? My workload, if you tomorrow had twice the number of cases assigned to you, regardless of the cause, your conditions of employment would have changed, right?
I'm not, absolutely, Your Honor. There is an impact on the employees, and they certainly, as they come in day to day, and it fluctuated over the years in this case.
So
the authority,
an administrability issue, really, of how to draw the line?
Exactly. The authority needs to draw a line, and here they've looked at the practicalities of the situation and determined we have a nice rule that if the agency is going to do it, it has control of that. It knows that when it's going to make a change to a practice, policy, or procedure, it also needs to notify the union when it involves a term condition of employment. The authority needs to draw the line somewhere and reasonably picked one that the agency could control.
How come you didn't challenge the arbitrator's finding that the contract was violated?
Challenge it. If the agency doesn't accept to the...
Right.
Then the authority is not going to...
I'm sorry, not the authority, the agency. Do you know why the agency did not... Sorry, I was mixing you up with the agency.
I don't, Your Honor. I think the concern was the unfair labor practice, the statutory violation, but that's as far as I can speculate on that. The union, and it's in front of the arbitrator, asked, recognizing that there's this line of cases and there's this precedent, says even if you're going to apply that precedent, which of course the authority is going to do, what the authority needs to do is change that rule and make a bright line that any time that there's some significant increase to the workload, the agency should be providing notice. The authority clearly stated that that was not in line with its precedent. The union switches its argument in its briefing and asks for substantial control. That wasn't directly before the authority. Nonetheless, similar to the bright line analysis, it doesn't line up with precedent. This is outside of the nice, clear, reasonable rule that the authority set, that if the agency doesn't implement or drive that change, the notice and obligation to bargain is not going to be triggered.
So just play it out for me so I understand. Under this bright line, the union can request bargaining. What happens next? The agency says, oh, these are management rights, how many cases are assigned, et cetera. This is not a negotiable.
In that case, the union could then appeal that decision, the agency's decision, saying that we don't need to negotiate over that, to the FLRA, and then the FLRA would make a determination whether or not it's a bargainable subject.
Well, let's assume it says it isn't in line with its case law.
The authority or the agency?
The authority.
Okay.
Then what?
If it's not, then that's the end of the story.
What I'm getting at is it's sort of a catch-22 here. You know, if the agency, recognizing that you're now handling four times as many cases as you previously did, but nevertheless requires you to complete all your work within 3 days, it says we're not changing our practice, all right? And you get a terrible performance evaluation under those standards. Because if we change our policy, then we have to give the union notice,
correct,
opportunity to bargain. So the matter never gets resolved, does it? That's what I'm trying to understand.
The scenario, and this isn't the case before the court, but this, I think the hypothetical you're describing wouldn't have that end. What we'd end up with is the union requesting bargaining, and if it's a negotiable workload issue.
Well, I just said, you know, the agency responds and says, you know, case assignment, management right, non-negotiable, FLRA agrees, then what?
Well, then it would be a situation where there would be no bargaining.
No remedy is what I'm getting at.
No remedy, you're right, Your Honor, if that's what the FLRA said. But if it's a workload condition, the union cites a number of cases about workload,
mm-hmm,
so that would be a bargainable, that could be a bargainable subject.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, the FLRA would likely send the issue back to, mm-hmm, the parties and tell them to bargain, tell the agency to bargain with the union over the impact of implementation, not necessarily over whether or not they can do it, but over how that affects the employees. So there would be a bargainable subject there.
All right, if you're finished, I wanted to ask you a question, but I didn't want to cut into your time. Do you have your order in front of you? I want to talk to you about footnote 11. This is the footnote that says...
This is your
the FLRA order.
Oh, the order. Okay,
footnote 11. And this says that, in effect, that if the IRS had accepted to the contract violation, you would have rejected that exception. And the case you cite for that, another IRS case, first of all, clearly had a change in working conditions because it was a reduction in inventory days. But that case, at least my reading of it, that IRS case said that the reason they rejected the IRS's exception based on the contract violation was that they made no separate contract argument and said it's simply, they didn't say it mirrored the statute, although it is. It's the exact same Article 47. And they didn't argue, IRS didn't argue that it mirrored the statute, didn't raise any separate contract issues, and therefore they rejected the contract violation exception. Now, my question is, first of all, the case is totally distinguishable because there was a change in working conditions, the reduction of inventory days. But it seems to me that Article 47, and I'm just asking you this because the FLRA went on to say if the IRS had accepted in this case, we would have rejected it. I can't see a difference between Article 47 and the statute as far as proposing a change. And so why would you have to make a separate contract argument for this case or even for the other IRS case? In other words, the proposing a change is in Article 47 is the same language as the statute.
In Article 47, the contract,
It says, either party may initiate the midterm bargaining by proposing changes. And then under A, where either party proposes changes, which is, it's not the identical language as of the statute, but it's as close as it needs to be to mirror it. And so, without asking why the IRS didn't accept to it, you don't know, we don't know.
Right.
But when the FLRA went on to say to the IRS, and if you had accepted, we would have rejected based on this other IRS case. I just don't follow that.
Well, for one, the parties that bargain the contract, in this language, there are nuanced differences. But with the contract comes the history of bargaining and a number of other things that could go into the arguments that may or may not be made by the parties, showing that it does or doesn't mirror the statutory language.
Well, can you tell me how, let's just say hypothetically, how this case violated Article 47?
The arbitrator found that it did. The authority didn't need to, and doesn't, get into
except
that.
Except in footnote 11, you say if we had reached it, we would have said it does violate it.
Other than what the authority says in footnote 11, I can't go much further. And you don't need it to decide this case.
Well, that's certainly true.
It's mystifying footnote 11.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Ms. Wilson have any time left? Why don't you take a couple minutes?
Thank you. I just have two very quick points. One, I want it to be very clear that the union's position here is consistent with FLRA precedent. As counsel for the FLRA has said, there is no question that changes in workload are a condition of employment that trigger an agency's statutory obligation. The number of cases, as they increased, triggered those requisite changes in workload. How employees performed their job, how employees were evaluated, increased anxiety, how the fact that they had to meet the same standards for quality and for timeliness. All of those factors the arbitrator expressly found were within IRS's control. And as a result, IRS is responsible for that change in employees' workload. My second point I wanted to make quite quickly, Judge Henderson, you had asked about when where do you draw the line about when the change occurred. Here, the arbitrator looked at all of the record evidence, and she concluded that that line was drawn in 2007, when employees were held, when they were evaluated for the first time under this increased workload, and were held to the, and were evaluated under the same performance standards. So in this case, the arbitrator concluded that the change happened in 2007. We do not need, rather, this court does not need to create a formulaic rule about when changes happen. Arbitrators are tasked with the responsibility of looking at the changes, the agency's role in it, how employees perform before and after the change, and they're tasked with that job of concluding when the change occurred. In this case, the arbitrator concluded it happened in 2007.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.